BBC One.
Our Words phone-in this week has a transatlantic flavour. It's a war of words, if you like, between Great Britain, on the left-hand corner, is that the blue corner, and the keepers of the Queen's English here, of course. And on the other corner, our American cousins who have taken the language in some interesting directions of their own, as I'm sure you know. So let's say welcome to Graham Donald, then, our resident etymologist and expert in the origins of customs, superstitions and popular misconceptions. And Graham, we'll know who you are because of your voice.
Oh, hi, Dalton.
Yeah, just not to confuse you with our next guest, a very warm welcome from Five Live to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, who jointly present a show called Away With Words on Radio KPBS in Denver. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello. Hi, we're gosh bustified to be here.
40-15, well, Dalton to serve.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, okay.
Now that's a good old Americanism.
I'll come back with the serve in just a moment. But thank you for kicking off the debate in such an elegant fashion. Thanks very much for that, Martha. And I'm sure our listeners will contribute with some serves of their own. 0500-909-693 is the number to call if you'd like to join us. As you can hear, it's going to be a fun discussion. Hope you can throw in your contributions as well on 0500 909 693. You can text us on 85058 or email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. Pete in West Yorkshire, just bear with me 2 seconds because I have to even up the score with these Yanks, you know. How they came out of the blocks flying. So from Mike in Leeds, and then for either of you, Grant or Martha, from Graham. From Mike in Leeds by text, why do Americans say lieutenant rather than lieutenant like us Brits?
Go ahead, Grant.
Just to be stubborn and ornery, mostly.
I'd say the Americans are right on that one. I mean, it comes from the French, you know, to hold in somebody else's place. To hold in someone else's place.
Yes,
I say the Americans are right.
I think you're right, Graham. I mean, I think the real question is, why do y'all say it wrong?
Well, yeah, fair enough. Let's throw that question in. Why do we all say it wrong?
Grant, over to you.
What is this, Canadian doubles?
Yes. Our pronunciation lacks as well. It's far from the French. Lieutenant, in an American accent doesn't sound very much like the French, not in the least. But there's something about that U, isn't there? There's something about that U that at some point became articulated as a labial sound, like an F. You could have lieutenant.
Yeah, it's one of those things like we were discussing earlier on in the studio about why, you know, we've got a politician over here called, well, his name's spelt Menzies, quite frankly, and we call him Ming. And you think, where does that come from then, Graham? Why do we pronounce things completely differently from how they're spelled?
Now, that transition from sort of what looks like Menzies to Mingus is, it's completely lost on me. I think probably Grant's a bit more up on that history of pronunciation and shift than I am.
Oh, but that's not a question that I've had before. I'm familiar with it. There's a whole universe of British style nicknames that just never made it across the pond, and that's one of them. It just doesn't show up here.
Mm.
Well, and part of the problem, too, here is that for years and years and years, hundreds of years, spelling wasn't codified. I mean, we spelled words all kinds of different ways. Yeah. If you open up the Oxford English Dictionary, you can see all kinds of alternate spellings.
Yeah. It still makes me laugh to see a movie where, you know, the words color is spelled C-O-L-O-R. You have to laugh. Or theater. Theater is the one that gets me. I mean, you do laugh. If you're in a British audience, you see the sort of camera pan across and it says, you know, this is the main center, C-E-N-T-E-R. The entire audience cracks up with laughter.
Is that right? Do they really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you film your movies in Technicolor with a U?
Well, yeah, I should hope so.
Well, we have Noah Webster to blame for that, a sort of New England blue nose who wanted to create a uniquely American language and differentiate ourselves. So we have all kinds of things like that, the U in color and favor and
harbor.
The R-E. Yes, indeed.
So who is this or what is a New England blue nose?
Well, that's sort of one of our puritanical forebears. A blue nose being someone who, I don't know, Grant, I mean, my sense of blue nose is that it's somebody who's rather prudish.
Yeah. It is. It's an archaic term at this point. It's not much used. You'll find it in some of the political dictionaries. Occasionally it's used in a political context. Most of the time if we use it today, we're very conscious of the fact that it's outdated. And it's almost somebody who... their nose is stuck so far up in the air that it cold from the heights.
Okay, well,
nice.
I'm glad you said stuck up in the air, because I thought we were going to go the way of the brown nose for a second. Anyway, 0500-909-693 is our number. Please join us this morning as we talk words. Any questions and comments about words that have flummoxed you or that you'd like to know the roots of, and indeed on superstitions and that kind of thing, general culture as well. Pete in West Yorkshire, thanks for waiting patiently. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering... because I've heard a while back that Roman Catholic priests would ask for, as a penance for people when they were admitting to various sins, is to state block, or say a couple of by our ladies or a number of them, and people started sprinkling this in language and it became the word bloody. And it's I've heard that it was the origin of the word bloody, but I've never really been sure whether this is true. And I was wondering what the resident etymologist had, whether he had ever come across this
origin. Well, there are three of them in the house.
Yes.
who would like to take up the mantle?
Three cornered hat.
Yeah, exactly. Who'd like to take up the mantle of how By Our Lady became bloody, if that's the case?
I personally wouldn't go with that. I don't think it is. I think that's a story invented.
It's a myth.
It is just a myth, or it's very often people sit down and try to construct sensible-sounding stories to explain what is already extant.
And, is it true that it was used as penance, though?
Well, no. What, by Our Lady, no. You probably had to go away and say a few Hail Marys, but not By Our Lady.
They didn't say By Our Lady.
No.
I would agree with Graham on that. That's one of those stories that sounds a little too good to be true, don't you think?
Yeah. I sort of state it that I thought, well, this just doesn't sound real. And I wanted to go... sometimes comes to mind and I think, no, I don't. I just want to get it right, one way or the other, whether it actually was.
Not that one, but some of those old, sort of archaic, sort of swear words or blasphemies did actually come from similar source, like, you know, gadzooks. Was God's hooks, the nails that he was, you know, supposedly hung on the cross with.
Right, or zounds.
Zounds,
like
God's wounds.
Zounds.
Yeah.
God's wounds. Yeah.
These are very good John Falstaff words, aren't they? Zounds, gadzooks.
You'll sound like Brian Blessed in a minute.
indeed. Grant and Martha, this is something that I've often wondered about, and I'm sure many of us have as well. We just don't understand, and neither does Robert in Ullapool, understand why pants when they're obviously trousers. I mean, look, pants are pants, and trousers are trousers.
Well, and let's not even talk about knickers and panties and the whole bit.
Yeah, and Y fronts and G strings and, you know, whatever men wear nowadays.
Yeah, but I'll just tell you right away, in North America, and this includes Canadians, if you say pants, you do not mean panties or underpants. It just is simply not the case ever here. Now, we may understand that. That you folks, when you say pants, you do mean underpants, but if we say pants, we mean outer pants, if that makes sense at all.
So is this from the Spanish pantaloons or something like that?
No, it's
French?
Nope, Italian.
Oh, Italian, yes. Oh.
Pantaleon, or lion.
But the pantalon is français aussi.
Yeah, but the original character, it was a character in the Comedy dell'arte, and Pantaleon, all lion. It was a Mickey-taking nickname because he was a blustering coward, and he wore these large, voluminous Turkish-style trousers. So pantaloons became, Pantaleon became pantaloon, cut down to pants.
It does sound kind of very unseemly when Yanks talk about pants, though, don't they? They say, you know, look,
dirty-minded Brit.
What's the problem?
Well, it's just that sometimes...
God, make them take it.
Well, sometimes when you say, look, I've got this little mark in my pants, then we're thinking, okay...
Okay,
exactly. That's what we're thinking of.
Oh, there's worse confusions, Dalton.
I'm sure there. I will try and unravel some of them tonight, I'm sure. I'm sure they'll come along. Andrew in Herefordshire. Good morning, sir.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Something that's confused me for a long, long time, and even my 9-year-old daughter brought it up tonight because it was on the Sacred Simpsons. Okay? In Great Britain, we speak the Queen's English, and when we go from A to B, it's a route. So yes. We go, that is the direction we're going in. Yet in, I think it's the northern states more than the southern, they say route, R-O-W-T. So we'll take this route instead of this route.
I think you'll find that that's widespread across the United States, that both of those are interchangeable. And sometimes you'll even find that within the same family, one family member will say route and another one will say route.
I think also, Grant, in the military, it tends to be more route.
So get your kicks on Route 66.
No, that doesn't work at all.
Okay.
No, that doesn't have the same ring to it. But I do think that a lot of military usage in this country ends up influencing our language. Grant and I were talking the other day about the word nuclear, which, dare I say that on the BBC?
How about aluminium and aluminium?
Aluminium, yeah.
Aluminium and
indeed.
Aluminium.
Indeed, I think we did deviate from.
I think you left a lot of the Queen's English or King's English when you went over there. You want to try and get it back again?
You
it's
know what,
great
really,
language.
What really cheeses me off, Andrew, is when they say math instead of the plural, which is of course mathematics. You know,
yeah.
It's not mathematic, is it?
That's right.
And it's not like you go to school and you get to do just one sum. It's a multiple choice, at least, at the very least.
Multi.
Well, there you go. Next, we'll be talking about schedule and schedule.
And it's
you're protesting about the American math instead of the British math. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, why is
do you
why is
play
it
one
singular?
Sport?
Oh, what's the difference between the
I listen to the BBC and they talk about this now for sport. I'm like, which one? Cricket?
Well, why can't
go on, weasel your way out of that, Donald.
Yeah, okay. Why can't you call it leverage? You call it leverage. It's not leverage, it's leverage. It's a leverage.
Sounds like the beginning of a song
one.
Here.
When you compare the language of these two countries, you just got to understand that this is a massive country. The distance between L.A. and New York is just about the distance between Madrid and Moscow. So the variance in the United States...
Moscow. It's Moscow. C-O-W.
Let's give them that one because, you know, I don't know how the Russians pronounce it. You get me? So we might find that they're more right than we are.
I think the Russians say mukbar, so we're all screwed.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call.
I'm from Birmingham anyway, so I shouldn't really be telling the Americans.
You're a Brum.
I'm originally Brummy, yeah.
Did you guys...
Brummagem.
Yeah, Birmingham.
Did you guys know what a Brum is, Grant and Martha? A Brum?
I would think that that's what you sell at a garage sale or a rummage sale.
Yes.
Is that, and it comes from Birmingham, as you all would say. My brother lives in Birmingham, Alabama.
That's a different Birmingham, I'm afraid.
No, she's right. It's the same one. It was Brummagem was sort of cheap imitation gold and silverware made in Birmingham in the 1900s.
Mm. So right, you guys gave us a lot of words like that, like tawdry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do you know that one? That's Saint Audrey.
Right, Saint Audrey's lace.
Yes, it was the lace fair down on the Isle of Ely.
Is that where it came from?
Yeah, and it gradually got debased with rubbishy merchandise, so Saint Audrey came down to tawdry.
Okay.
So you guys are saying that we are debasing the, the Queen's English?
No,
is that what?
Not at all. I mean, some people, we do wonder sometimes, but we're giving you the benefit of the doubt until Spanish takes over as your national language. We're leasing you the language for a while. Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. Let me invite listeners to pick up the phone and call us on 0500 909 693. It is a very special words phone-in this morning because we're talking about words across the Atlantic, particularly our guest in the States or in the North North America, I should say, are Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, who jointly present a show called Away With Words on Radio KPBS. And, of course, our own Graham MacDonald, our resident etymologist, is with us as well.
You slipped a Mac in there.
Did I say Mac? It's the Menzies Campbell things on my mind. Menzies Mingus, whatever it is.
Yeah, Ming the Terrible.
And before we go to the next call, let me just ask each of you this, actually. I'd like each of you to answer what you think. It's not necessarily American English translation, but from Sheridan, who's flooded out in Hull tonight. And I do hope that we can keep you warm for a while longer, Sheridan. Who asked, could you ask your words expert which is the biggest compliment, the bee's knees, or, I'll say it the Benny Hill way, the dog's rollocks? And also, where do the phrases come from?
Oh.
Well.
What?
I was just going to ask, the dog's what?
Gonads, testicles.
Well, yeah.
What, could you spell, a, what's the word
that you're utilizing?
The mutt's nuts is another way of putting it.
Yes, yes.
You've actually done a show with a priest from Texas where we talked at length with him about that word, and it was broadcast over the air.
Oh, that's right.
Well, yeah, even at this time of the night, I'll go the Benny Hill way. The dog's rollers, but I do like the mutt's nuts.
Wait, I want to know how to spell this. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's an English expression which started off meaning blatantly obvious and then came to mean shifted to mean prominent, significant, and thus very good. And
right, but what's the word? How do you spell it?
Oh, dear.
Well, Martha, they're trying to avoid it because they can't say it on the air.
I didn't realize that.
And it rhymes with frolic.
Yeah, but you can spell it. You basically change the R for
a
B.
I have it.
Right, and I don't know if that means anything in the States. It's nothing to do with cows, you know. That's bullocks. That's a slightly different thing. But this is the dog's rollocks, then. The mutt's nuts or the badger's natchers, have you heard of
that?
We could go on and on and on. But which for you sounds like the biggest compliment? If somebody says, oh, it's the bee's knees, or...
I'd say it just depends on the company.
I know, the dog's rollocks. It's got to be the dog's rollocks, really, hasn't it?
I would say it depends on the decade. Is it 1920?
I'm sorry?
It depends on the decade. Is it 1920?
No. Contemporary, if you don't mind.
What year are we in? If it's 1920, then it's the bee's knees.
Yeah, the bee's knees is. That's from then. There was some attempt to say it was from the Italian. It's the bee's knees. It's the business, but I don't really go with that. Because it's like the cat's whiskers, the bee's knees, the dog's whatnots.
Right, the dog's whatnots. I like that. Yes. The eel's ankles, the elephant's instep. There were a whole lot of this in the 1920s. I think in the United States.
So what would the equivalent colloquial big compliment be in America then? I mean, instead of the bee's knees, when you really want somebody to say, look, this is the business, what would you say? What's the equivalent of the dog's rollocks?
Well, it changes by the year. I'd say the problem here is that you're trying to say what we used to say the bomb, but that's about 7 or 8 years out of date, right, Martha?
Old. It's even old here. I mean, I listen to my hip-hop records. I haven't heard the bomb since the days of Public Enemy.
But what we do find here is the adjective, for just the adjective form, not a noun. Sweet still has a really strong hold on the young Americans.
It's sweet.
Everything is sweet. You've got that from us. Drawn-out conversations peppered with the word sweet.
Sorry to... Well, look, you have got that from us. We used to say that back in the day. Oh, it's sweet, it's sweet.
We've
moved on. Yeah, that's years old, years old. I mean, really, is that the...
You used to hear that in the Sweeney.
Well, there you go. Sweet. Sweet as a nut.
Yeah.
Sweet as a nut is where it comes from. That's a bit of Cockney rhyming slang. I don't know if you've ever heard this record. It's a really fantastic record. By a guy called, Graham, I don't know if you've heard this, I'm sure our Yankee friends haven't, but it's by a guy called Smiley Culture. It's called Cockney Translation. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I've not done.
You've never heard of that?
No, I'm not too up on contemporary music.
Okay, I'll get you the translation in a moment. I'll Google it for you. But
right.
It basically says Cockney's not a language. It is only a slang. It was originated, yes, in England. It wasn't used by each and every man. It was sickly con man and also the villain. Cockney have names like Terry Arthur and Leroy. No, Terry Arthur and Lloyd. We have names like Leroy. Anyway, I'll give it to you in a moment. Dick in Deptford, good morning.
Oh, talking of Cockney slang.
Exactly.
Is an authority.
Exactly.
I just want to tell you the last line of a 160-year-old ditty, which everybody knows.
Uh-oh.
That is, Pop Goes the Weasel.
Good for you.
Now, there's about five or six verses to it,
mm-hmm.
and they are all concerned with the use of money and the need for it. And the Pop Goes the Weasel... I'll just go one verse, quick, the first verse. Up and down the city road, in and out the Eagle, which was the pub. That's the way the money goes, Pop goes the weasel. Now, Pop, as many people know, was the English for pawn. It's not used much now because there's not many pawnbrokers. But the weasel doesn't make sense. What it actually meant and is was the whistle. Pop goes the whistle, which is short for whistle and flute. And I must admit that there was a period in my life when I popped my whistle and flute. And of course, that woman doesn't know what the, you know, listening to Rollock, she doesn't know the nearest you can get to a word by saying a brick lighthouse instead of what the obvious is. So... I hope I made myself clear.
Yeah, I think so.
I think so, yeah. Don't underestimate Martha.
I know about raspberry tarts, but that's about it.
Ooh, I haven't heard that one for a long, long time.
Yeah, as in blowing a raspberry, yeah.
Well, yes.
Well, we've got some good names like Featherstone, or is Fainshaw.
Yeah.
And Chumley.
Yeah.
Chumley. And Mousehole is Mousel.
It's Cornwall, isn't it?
Yeah. Interesting. But the slang is interesting because it's so, you know, it changes all the time. And if you're with it, you can guess. I mean, Farmer Giles was an awful complaint.
Mm.
And modern people call it the chowpon, St. Giles.
Yes.
And
but
so
you've got to move up market with inflation.
Yeah, of course. But it's always interested me because it has its humour. And the only slang I know that comes near it is the Australian. The American slang is humourless.
Now then.
Well, listen,
yeah.
I've got five American grandsons. And my daughters have been in America for 40 years. And I'm very familiar with American lingo. I should be going there in a couple of weeks. But there's nothing to compare with Australian slang.
Dick, you're throwing down the gauntlet. Our American friends want to challenge you on that. We're going to give them the opportunity to do that as soon as we come back from the BBC at 5 Live News and Sport. Dick, you've got to keep listening. It's your challenge. They're going to convince us that American slang has got some humour to it. The jury's out for another few minutes at least. 0500 909 693. If you'd like to join us this morning talking words, you know where to call. 0500 909 693. Text us on 85058 or indeed email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. At weasel and stoat is coat, says GF. Thanks for that.
Live news, live sport.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
It's 3 o'clock, good morning. Nick Wallace has the 5 Live news.
The kidnappers of a 3-year-old British girl seized in Nigeria yesterday have offered to exchange her for her father. Margaret Hill was taken from her parents' car as she was being driven to school in the town of Port Harcourt. Her mother told the BBC the kidnappers have threatened to kill Margaret, but the police have advised her husband not to swap places. A BBC survey has found evidence that British imams lack the language and professional skills to help tackle radicalism among young Muslims. The study found that fewer than 1 in 10 imams was born in Britain and most sermons were given in Urdu. Here's our religious affairs correspondent Robert Piggott.
The study revealed a rapid influx of imams into Britain, almost three-quarters within the last decade. 86% had a South Asian language as their mother tongue, with Urdu, well ahead of English, as the dominant language of preaching. The survey, carried out among 300 mosques by Chester University, suggested that overwhelmingly imams had only a foreign seminary education. Muslim leaders have warned that many imams lack the skills to interpret Islam for a modern, secular, multicultural country, leaving many young Muslims at risk of recruitment by radical activists.
It's emerged that two of the suspects detained in Britain in connection with the attempted car bombings in London and Glasgow had applied to work as doctors in Australia, but were rejected. They were turned down because of the quality of their degrees and deficiencies in their character references. The government is giving secondary schools in England an extra £13 million to help teach them social and emotional skills. Pupils will be taught how to deal with anger and anxiety, how to resolve conflicts, and how to recover from setbacks. The aim is to give them more self-confidence and better manners. Welsh Labour Party delegates are holding a special conference today to decide whether the minority Labour administration in the Welsh Assembly should share power with Plaid Cymru. The proposal by the First Minister, Rhodri Morgan, has divided party members in Wales. Wira Davis reports from Cardiff.
Since Welsh elections 9 weeks ago, no single party has an overall majority in the Assembly. And despite many attempts to put a deal together, no long-term solution has been reached. Now that may be resolved if the Wales Labour Party supports a plan to enter a formal coalition with Plaid Cymru. The deal, upon which First Minister Rhodri Morgan is staking his political credibility, is controversial and has been criticised by many Labour traditionalists. With the prospect of Plaid ministers in a Welsh government for the first time, one Labour MP said the party was committing suicide and walking into a nationalist trap.
A report says around 1 million people are paying the wrong amount of income tax because of errors by Revenue and Customs. The study by the National Audit Office found that the average mistake last year was more than £250. The errors represent 5% of cases. Five Live Sport now with Susan Spence.
For a while yesterday, the weather relented at Wimbledon. Anna Ivanovic saved three match points to beat Nicole Vidasova and set up a semi-final with Venus Williams, who had earlier pulled off a surprise straight sets victory over Svetlana Kuznetsova. Rafael Nadal came from two sets down to beat Mikhail Yuzny, while Novak Djokovic made it through to the last eight in a closely fought match against the former champion Leighton Hewitt. There were also wins for Thomas Berdych and Marcus Bogdatis. Aston Villa have signed West Ham's Nigel Rio-Coker for £8.5 million. The midfielder took a swipe at his former club, saying he felt he was made a scapegoat for their poor season and was hung out to dry. Sheffield United will appeal to the High Court on Friday, July 13th over the Carlos Tevez affair and their Premiership relegation. Sussex qualified for the quarter-finals in the 2020 Cup with victory over Surrey at the Oval last night, and St Helens, Bradford and Wigan have been charged with breaching the Rugby Super League salary cap during the 2006 season.
It's 11:10, 9:08, 7:06, 5:04, 3:02, 1. It's I, Smiley Culture, with the mic in me hand. Me come to teach you the right and not the wrong in a Cockney translation. Cockney's not a language, it is only a slang. It was originated just in England. The first place it was used was over East London. It was respect for different style pronunciation, but it wasn't really used by any man. Mainly strict con man, also the villain, but threw me full up of lyrics and education. Right here now, me going to give you a little translation. Cockney have names like Terry Arthur and Del Boy. We have names like Winston, Lloyd and Leroy. We ball out, yeah, while Cockneys say oi. What Cockneys call a jacks, we call a blue boy. Say Cockney have mates while we have spa. Cockney live in a drum while we live in a yard. So we get nyam while Cockney get capture. Cockney say governor, we say big voucher. In a Cockney translation. As from Smiley Culture, we're talking words, of course, so just give you a little translation. Just in case you're a yardie and you get stuck in the East End and you need a little bit of translation going on, you get, oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, our guest this evening, our Graham Donald, our resident etymologist. etymologies. We've also welcomed to the show for the first time Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from the States, who jointly present a show called Away With Words on Radio KPBS Endeavour. Like to have your company as well, talking words, Yankee words and English words and transatlantic words. Dick in Deptford challenged our American guests to prove that American slang had humour. Okay then, go on then, make us laugh.
Incoming.
Well, look, I would just like to say that our American poet Carl Sandburg said that slang is a language that rolls up its sleeves, spits on its hands, and gets to work. And I think that happens in all kinds of different languages, including American English and British English. But I'm going to turn this over to Grant, because Grant is not bragging about the fact that he's a real expert on slang. If you go to his website, if you go to his website, doubletongued.org, you will learn more about slang than you can ever possibly imagine. So, Grant, show them how great we are.
I can't know that. Although, the first thing I have to say is I dated an Australian girl for a while, and I will tell you, that stuff is funny the first time. The second time, maybe. Not the third time. It gets old fast.
I'll tell you one thing that's amusing several of our listeners, and I don't know if you consider this slang or not stateside, but we've had about three texts so far asking why you say fanny. What's that all about? That's from Simon.
Are you allowed to say that?
Well, we're doing it the American way. I'm giving you the opportunity. I mean, oh, does it mean something else?
Yeah, don't get this back to front.
I'm getting it back to front, aren't I? Okay.
Well, I'm leaving you there, drowning
okay.
boy.
Okay. Let me pull back from that and go to our listeners. 0500 909 693. We do find that a bit funny anyway. Ian in Northampton, good morning, sir.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm very well, and I'm grateful to you for getting me out of that hole.
That's no problem. I had to smile earlier when somebody said we all speak Queen's English over here. The only person that speaks that is the Queen.
Of course.
I mean, because I've always said that I'm going to have a bath. She would say bath.
Well,
if somebody was overweight, I'd say that person's fat. I don't know what she'd say.
Well, she doesn't even speak English. She speaks Annus Horribilis.
Well, and don't you guys take baths rather than have them?
That's true. Right, we have baths.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you can't take the bath anywhere you want. I mean, you need some help, but a bath is quite a heavy implement.
You can if the builders aren't there.
This is true.
You see, Dotton, you're saying bath as well.
It is bath, of course, if you come from southern England. You know
where's the R in it?
Yes. Okay.
Anyway, my question is for the guests from the colonial country. We've let the colonies go now, but never mind. The word stymies, which I discovered a couple of weeks ago, was baffled.
Stymie,
yeah. I mean, why would the Americans use that word?
That's a golf word, isn't
it?
Yeah. You're talking about to hinder somebody, to get in the way, or to block somebody, right?
It's like a snooker. It's a golfing snooker, isn't it?
Yeah,
well, you see, the only reason I realised what it was actually on an American, it was Murder, She Wrote. And on the opening sequence, it's got on the page of the newspaper that she's reading, Murder, Stymies, Cops. And for weeks I sat there thinking, what the hell does stymies mean? And she actually used it in the programme one week. And it's, like I say, to us, that means you're baffled.
Hmm. Yeah, baffled, snookered, perplexed, blocked.
Yeah.
An impasse.
The origin of it is clouded in mystery. It clearly does come from golf, but it was euphemized and made figurative pretty quickly. The first use is outside of golf to refer just to a general way of blocking or a general blocking of somebody. Showed up about 2 decades later.
So it was a golfing term then?
Yeah, it was. As far back as the 1830s.
Hmm.
On both shores, actually.
Well, actually, the person that phoned me back said that he had heard it in this country. He's obviously a member of a golf club.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I'd never come across it.
There is a Scots term that it might be related to, Stime, S-T-Y-M-E, but that's vague and uncertain. You're going to get a lot of hedging and hemming and hawing and caveats and where to fores and whereases out of me.
You're not a lawyer, are you?
He's a lexicographer.
Yes, yes. How vague can you be and still make people buy your dictionary? That's the goal.
Ian, let's leave it there if you don't mind. We need to move on. Thanks very much for the call. June in East Sussex. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Hi, June.
Hi. Yes, a word which, when I was younger, I used to hear a lot, is furlough. The American servicemen would say they're taking or on their furlough. We used to say, oh, why don't they say leave like everybody else? But furlough turned out to be an old English word, which they still use, as is gotten. We used to use the word gotten. We only use it in the form of forgotten now. But there are several words in West Indies as well, old English words still used, you know?
Mm.
The pronunciation isn't different. But if anyone wonders about how difficult English is, the same spelling applies to cough and rough and bough of a tree and salt after a person, bought an article, and I have a relative living in Howgate Close, spelled H-A-U-G-H.
yes.
So, it's not easy, but, go easy on our American guests, okay?
No, we love them. You know we love them. They're,
yes.
they're so quaint, especially when they speak English from the Victorian ages, because
As do the Kingstonians.
As they do, indeed. You're absolutely right.
In Jamaica.
And as do the Look. French Canadians speak like French of 100 years ago. I travelled with this French Canadian guy, and when we were in France,
yes.
as soon as he opened his mouth, everybody would fall around with laughter. They couldn't believe it.
Well, yes, you're right. I had a Canadian, Monique, a Canadian, French-Canadian neighbour in France, in the Corrèze, and we'd go to the butcher's and she'd say, he'll know straight away I'm from Canada, but then we know if people are from Australia. We know if people are from New Zealand, South Africa, you see? A different accent. Language evolves. It's like the Galapagos Islands, yeah? Stuff evolves, doesn't it?
It does.
Absolutely.
What's the other thing I was going to say? Euphemism. I've had my niece and nephew from Jamaica via New York staying with me, and I have a bathroom, and separately I have what we call a toilet. I like to call it a lavatory, but still, mostly it's a toilet. And my terribly polite, well-brought-up Jamaicans, Aunt June, I'm going to use the bathroom. And I'd say, okay, so I'd go into the toilet. Americans call the toilet the bathroom, that's my point, yeah?
Indeed.
Yeah? It's more polite, isn't it?
Yeah,
if we're polite and in a department store, we'll say we want the ladies, we're going to the ladies. Or they say the powder room and the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm. Or the restroom.
Restroom, yeah.
No rest.
But why the confusion, you know, with Michael and Amanda and Deanne and me? We don't... five of us.
I personally,
I said, this is the toilet, right?
I personally don't care what the Yanks call it, as long as those waiters wash their hands when they come out of it, because apparently in New York they're not too keen on that. June, thanks very much for that.
No, yeah. There's a line over the sink in every restaurant in New York City that says employees must wash hands.
I heard
now, whether they're supposed to wash your hands or somebody else's hands, they don't say. But.
I heard this on David Letterman, and then afterwards I went with a friend to buy a pizza, and the pizza guy serving the pizza just grabs on of his Rolex, you know, the Rolex, and, has a good scratch of his Rolex and then hands us over the pizza. That's New York for you. I don't care. Look, we call that the bog here because when you say you're going to the bog, everybody knows what you mean. It's the bog. Bog.
Bog.
Yeah, and when you're taking a dog for a walk, basically the dog's going to the bog.
Right, I get it.
Okay.
I should say, though, to the American ear, toilet just sounds crass. It sounds just a little crude.
Toilet?
Yeah.
I mean, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with the toilet?
You can kind of hear the swirling.
It's not far enough removed. You know, we're
as long as you don't hear the bowel movements, you can hear the swirling. But not the bowel movements.
Do you know what? Our show got, our show Away With Words got an email from a listener in Wisconsin today, and he had just returned from London, and he was baffled by all these signs that said to let outside of flats or apartments, and he said it was so hard for me to resist the temptation to go and put an I in that word, in that combination of letters.
People do.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's sort of like when I was in college, people kept taking the I out of the recital hall.
What Americans love, the signs they love when they come over here, amongst them are, you know, our exit signs say way out. And
right.
My American friends say, wow, that's cool, way out, man. Way out, yeah.
But you know,
where's that Australian slang that you were telling us about? I have yet to hear any.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll hear some. Jim in Edinburgh, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, get back onto this Mingy's and Menzies business. What's it all about?
In Scotland, it's always been Mingus.
No, it hasn't. What about John Menzies?
Well, John Menzies changed their name to Menzies because they wanted to have business in England. But it was John Mingus when I was a child, and that was 60-odd years ago. And that's just a change in the recent year. But I was going to say that language changes in Britain. It's changed more quickly than it has in America. And America is still using a lot of the language that was taken over by the original settler, whereas the language over here has been influenced by Europe a great deal more than they have, because their nearest neighbours are the Spanish and, of course, then the North Canadians.
Well, that's not to say... Well, I should stop you there and say that, of course, we are influenced by the Spanish from Mexico and the Latin American countries. Absolutely. I can recite you dozens of new words that have shown up in American English that don't appear in British English, so it changes. It really does. Do you know the word chonies? We were talking about panties before. Chonies is Mexican Spanish slang for underpants or pants. And yep. It's just one of a dozen. The sheetrock carol. Do you know what sheetrock is? What do you use for drywall or gypsum board over there?
Sorry?
Drywall?
Plasterboard.
We call it a dike. A dry stain dike.
No, we call it plasterboard. I think you mean... Yeah.
But we call it sheetrock, and so among the Latin American tradesmen who work in the construction business, they call themselves sheetrock caros, taking that ERO suffix from Spanish and tacking it on to the English word.
So you had me stymied for the meaning of that word just a minute ago. And that's a word that we use in Scotland quite frequently. You were talking about a New England person being a blue nose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that originates from the fact it's not unconnected to the term WASP, and that was when the first people who were able to go to Harvard and Yale, etc., were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And across in Scotland, we still have the term of blue nose, but that's usually referred to as somebody who supports the Rangers Football Club, which is a very pro-Protestant football club.
Okay, so I think it goes
away back to the conflict between the green and the blue, the colours of the various people who were fighting the wars in 1690.
Not to mention football versus soccer.
We won't go down there.
I should say there is a Scots connection. The Historical Dictionary of American Slang, which I worked on for a time, under the entry for blue nose, does say that the earliest quotation is couched in Scots.
Yeah.
Apparently a contemptuous name for a Scots Presbyterian. Dates to about 1698, 1706, somewhere around there.
Well, the Scots have a great connection with the English language because Sir James Murray was a Scot. A lot of people don't realize that. He was the founder of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Well, the OED has had, most of its editors haven't been speakers of RP.
Pardon?
Most of the editors, the main editors of the OED, have been from the, how should we put this, the outer dialects of English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. And of course, Scots, it's interesting because just a few miles around Edinburgh, there's little towns, and they have different words for things. I mean, I worked in these towns, and very often I had to ask what exactly the meaning was. You know, they would talk about the good doctor. And that turns out to be the daughter-in-law. Not an expression we use at all in Edinburgh.
Hmm.
Now, I've got a question for you. I always point this out to folks, and you sound like the right man for this. Did you know that the Dictionary of Scots Language is freely available online? They put this up a couple of years ago. It's a combination of the Scottish National Dictionary, the Dictionary of Old Scottish Tongue, some supplements. It's a fantastic historical work, and it's free.
Yes. I didn't know that, but I've got a copy of Chambers Scots Dictionary, which is produced some years ago. And that's very informative. But it's very difficult to formulate a dictionary in Scotland because different counties, as I say, the word changes from the east to the west, from the north to the south. Mm. And even the pronunciation, I mean, there's links to down to Norfolk. And, of course, what of that comes to do with the Vikings, the way the Vikings spoke and the influence that the people on the east coast were influenced by the sea traders as opposed to people on the west coast. For example, they talk about chimneys in parts of England and Scotland. My father was a boarder and he spoke about a chimney. Now there's no L in the word chimney, but that was the way he pronounced it, and it's
well now you'll actually find that that pronunciation is common throughout the English speaking world.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the Scots brought it there, but it does exist in the United States even today.
That's interesting, yeah. Well, they speak about chimneys down in Norfolk as well.
Mm-hmm. It's good to know that the old dialects still have sway. I read so many reports about the language becoming bland and generic, and it's just nice to hear that people are still speaking with color.
Well, I'm in my mid to late 60s now, and we were not allowed to speak in a dialect when I was at school. But we went out into the playground and reverted back to normal. Now the Scots language is encouraged, and there is a degree now in Scots. There was a long time where the language of Scots was suppressed, wasn't thought to be a language, just a corruption and bad English.
Language is very powerful. Jim, thanks very much for telling us about that. We've got a couple more Scottish listeners to go to in just a moment or two. Just this very quickly for our American guests. This is from John in Dorset. Why do Yanks call the toilet the John? Ask John.
Oh, there's another one that's shrouded in mystery, the history of that one. Graham, you and I had discussed that over a couple of pints of Guinness recently.
We did, yes, because that's the first thing I heard you discuss on your show with Grant, when the lady who wrote in saying she wanted to write the history of John's in my life or whatever.
Oh, she was writing it, and it was a picture book.
God, yes, flushed with
yes.
pride.
Or something like that.
Yeah, because
yes.
it was, well, wasn't it, it used to be known as Jake's, didn't it?
I believe so.
And the first book about the loo was, wasn't it, The Metamorphosis of Ajax, he called it.
I am still waiting for the movie to come out. I
yeah. But I think it's just, I said that always digs up the old debate about whether Jack is a pet form of James or John.
Well, in the United States, it's definitely of John.
Yeah, but if you look, well, the supporters of James Stewart were the Jacobites.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's a lobby of opinion over here which would say that Jack is the biform of James, not
well,
John.
And speaking about euphemisms, I remember reading that there was a phrase, "I'm going to go visit my cousin John's," which meant I'm going to go to the, as we would say, go
the
to
little
the bathroom,
boy's room, yeah.
And it became known as a cuz John, and it may have been shortened that
right.
way. I think we're not completely sure about that, but
no,
we do have
bit.
All kinds of euphemisms for going to the bathroom, going to the restroom. My favorite is something about I'm going to go pick a rose.
mine is a little cruder. My favorite is I'm going to drop some friends off at the lake.
I'm going to have to go and see a man about a dog in a minute, so let's move on very swiftly to Andrew in Milngavie in Glasgow. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning to
so
you.
More about Ming Campbell, then.
Yes, I was listening with some interest on my way home from work. It's just regarding the name Mingus or Menzies. Can maybe clear it up for you, or hopefully. It's actually a Scottish Gaelic name, or Gaelic, as some people pronounce it nowadays. The Gaelic form was originally Menius, which was again originally a Norman name, but the Gaels took the name on board and pronounced it Menius. And when the name was introduced into the lowlands gradually, and written down by scribes who were probably either Scots-speaking or English-speaking. They introduced the Scots Z into the name, which is actually pronounced Y, and they used that to replicate the Y sound in menus. Mm. And that's how you get the name. Although it looks like Menzies, it should be pronounced Menzies. And eventually, in the lowlands anyway, the name was pronounced Mingus. And this is where we get the name Ming from. The Z actually features in a couple of other Scottish surnames, like DL, which is spelled D-A-L-Z-I-E-L, which is again another Gaelic word, Dal Yal, which means a white dale. And it also features in the name Yule, which nowadays is mainly spelt Y-U-L-E or Y-U-I-L-L, but there are still some variants who spell it Z-U-I-L or Z-U-L-E. Again, it features in the name Mackenzie. The Z is actually a Y sound to replicate the Gaelic sound. In Gaelic, the name is actually Marconi, or Marconi, with a lighter CH at the end of the name. And the only other name I can think of, which is not very common nowadays, is the name of an old footballer from Dundee, Alan Gilzean.
Oh yeah.
And his name really should have been pronounced Gillehang, well, which is again a Scots Gaelic name, and that introduces a Z, so that'll help you.
It would have been difficult for the commentators, as you know, but he's a great footballer. Andrew, thanks a lot for that. Neil, okay, in Glasgow as well. Great history, Andrew. Neil, good morning.
Morning, Don. How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks very much. Appreciate you talking to us.
I can't believe Andrew didn't point out to you there that it's not pronounced Mungavi, it's pronounced Mulgai.
Well, he was so polite as not to correct me. I do apologise.
He seems to know more about it than me, so maybe it's not pronounced that way. But
it's Netherly, at least pronounced Netherly.
It's Netherly, yeah, but it's actually Cathcart, I'm in.
Okay.
So it's just pronounced Cathcart. But when you were talking about Americanisms earlier, to our American friends there, one that really bugs me, and it's a sporting term, is they say winningest.
No,
the winningest team in baseball.
That
so I can say, like, Celtic
incorrect.
Are the winningest team in Scotland.
Oh.
Right. You know, winning
but
is
it's not a word, surely.
Yeah, it's sure it is. And it's more than 100 years old.
Yeah, right.
No,
it's in some dictionaries.
Yeah, it's not even specifically American.
Well, it might be in American dictionaries. Are you sure it's grammatically correct in English?
Well, it exists and people use it and they talk and I hear it on the radio and I read it in the newspapers, both sides of the pond, actually throughout the Anglosphere. Yeah, it's a real word.
Well, it's as real a word as Louise Bennett, the great poet, saying that the extension of worse is worst and then worsera and worserara.
Quesarara.
Yeah,
well, now there's useful and there's funny and sometimes they do not match.
This is true. What about Yank, Neil? Doesn't that bug you when they talk about Yanks and Yankee? What's all that about, Neil?
We don't.
Yankees?
Yeah, you know, where's that word come from? What, you don't call each other Yanks?
Never.
you lot don't call each other Yanks?
Well, I might call Grant a Yankee because he lives up in New York and I'm from the South.
Yeah, I'm talking to you from New York City and she's talking to you from San Diego, and so we're coast to coast and the largest sense of the word, but yeah.
But where does the word come from, Yank?
Probably from the Dutch.
Dutch.
Johnny Cheese.
Mm-hmm. But to call a Southerner a Yankee, them's fighting words.
That's the highest insult of all time?
Yes.
You can only do worse with carpetbagger.
Yes, that's a good old American word.
Or just accuse them of being a cattle rustler. That'll do it too.
I didn't realize that carpetbagger was a word until I read Harold Robbins as a young boy. But anyway, that's another story. Listen, it's been great speaking to you. We've got to do this again because we've been totally swamped with text messages, emails and calls that we couldn't put on. And I do apologize to all of those who have contacted us. It's been really good discussing this transatlantic language of ours. Grant and Martha, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Hey, as we say, as we say in Arkansas, I ain't had so much fun since the hogs ate my little brother up.
Can't be that. We cannot be that. And the gentleman who said that Yankee slang wasn't humorous.
Yeah,
there we go.
Thanks very much Grant Barrett there and Martha Barnett also from Radio KPBS. And also, thanks very much to Graham Donald. Look forward to the next time, gentlemen and lady.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV and online,
this is 5 Live.
Nick Wallace has the 5 Live news.
The mother of Margaret Hill, the 3-year-old British girl seized in Nigeria, says her kidnappers have offered to exchange her for her father. Aluchi Hill told the BBC the kidnappers have also threatened to kill her daughter. A BBC survey has found evidence that British imams lack the skills to help tackle radicalism among young Muslims. The study found that fewer than 1 in 10 imams was born in Britain, and most sermons were given in Urdu. It's emerged that two of the suspects detained in Britain in connection with the attempted car bombings in London and Glasgow had applied to work as doctors in Australia. They were turned down because of the quality of their degrees and deficiencies in their character references. The government is giving secondary schools in England an extra £13 million to help them teach social and emotional skills. Pupils will be taught how to resolve conflicts and how to recover from setbacks. Welsh Labour Party delegates are holding a special conference today to decide whether the minority Labour administration in the Welsh Assembly should share power with Plaid Cymru. The proposal by the First Minister, Rhodri Morgan, has divided party members in Wales. 5 Live Sport now with Susan Spence.
At Wimbledon, the weather relented a little, allowing enough time for the two outstanding ladies' singles quarterfinals to be played and for several men's matches to be completed. With details of Day 10, here's Jonathan Overend.
An outstanding day of tennis, even if it was cut short by the inevitable rain, with action around every turn. From Anna Ivanovic saving match points to beat Nicole Vidasova, to Rafael Nadal coming from two sets down to beat Mikhail Yuzhny with the finest grass court tennis he's ever played. From a four-hour, four-set classic with Novak Djokovic seeing off Leighton Hewitt, to another comprehensive performance from Venus Williams. Then there was more mixed doubles success for Britain, with wins for Jamie Murray, partnering Jelena Jankovic, and for Alex Bogdanovic and Mel South, and the colourful Cypriot fans adding their own unique atmosphere to the outside courts in support of the beaming Marcus Baghdatis, the sort of day Wimbledon was invented for.
Play begins on all courts at 11 o'clock this morning, with full coverage here on 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra. Aston Villa's new signing Nigel Riococca says he's looking forward to a fresh start after a tough season at Upton Park. The midfielder, who's moved from West Ham in an £8.5 million deal, was blamed by fans and critics for the club's slump in form as they spent much of the season in the bottom three. Sheffield United will appeal to the High Court on Friday, July 13th over the Carlos Tevez affair and their relegation from the Premier League. The chairman, Kevin McCabe, says he wants £50 million in compensation after confirming the club will continue to fight their relegation.
Where that will take us, I really don't know. But I do think it is worthwhile, not just for Sheffield United, who we work to protect in every instance, but worthwhile for the integrity of this sport. Now, I do not believe, regrettably, that will see our reinstatement. I think we've gone beyond that in time. It is frustrating, I know, but that is the case.
And Sheffield have signed the defender Gary Naismith from Everton, while it's still goalless between Argentina and Paraguay in the Copa America. St Helens, Bradford and Wigan have been charged with breaching the Super League salary cap during the 2006 season. They'll appear before an independent tribunal over the next few weeks. England's Robert Rock is the highest placed Briton after the opening round of Golf's European Open in Ireland. He shot a 5 under par 65, one shot off the lead from the K Club Andrew Cotter.
Free Ticket Thursday is how the opening day of the European Open is now billed, an initiative which brought 23,000 through the gates of the K Club, and those fans certainly deserve better conditions. Heavy rain in the morning and a saturated course. Perhaps they could also feel slightly let down by their golfing heroes. Home favourites Padraig Harrington and Paul McGinley misfired in 1 over par 71s. Colin Montgomery and David Hull marginally better, returning 1 under par 69s. Those scores, though, still 5 behind the leader, Holland's Martin Lefebvre, who's 6 under under 64 was a bogey-free round, with Sweden's Nicholas Fass, perhaps the most dangerous of those in a group, a shot further back. But the best result of the day, the weather forecast, which promises drier conditions over the next 3 days.
And Sussex qualified for the quarter-finals in the 2020 Cup with victory over Surrey at the Oval last night. Only the bare minimum of 5 overs were possible because of poor conditions.
Get your 5 Live podcasts from the 5 Live website. bbc.co.uk/5live.
Including 606.
You made some good points, mate. I'm watching the game, holding my head in my hands.
Sports Week, Wake Up to Money, The Daily Mail, Mark Kermode's film reviews, and Fighting Talk. Click on the podcast link on the 5 Live homepage. You'll find full instructions on how to download.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Now, my next guest is the American writer Julianne Hoffman. You might have read one of her 2 previous novels. Her new book's called Plea of Insanity, and it's a thriller aiming to inform about mental health issues, namely schizophrenia. Julianne is a former legal professional turned crime writer. She was an assistant state attorney in Miami and then an advisor to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, advising special agents on complex investigations. Her job was to write the search warrants, arrest warrants, and authorized wiretaps. Before we talked about her writing, I asked her to tell me more about her work with the special agents.
Well, I was a regional legal counsel, a police legal advisor for the Department of Law Enforcement in Miami. And we worked on complex criminal investigations, including the serial killing of Gianni Versace back in 1997 and those sort of investigations, child abductions, missing children, organized crime investigations, and other assorted homicides that would fall within the jurisdiction of multi-counties in Florida.
It sounds exciting, but weren't you just a pen pusher?
Well, I was the only lawyer for about 100 to 150 special agents from all of South Florida. So I was more than a pencil pusher. I was able to help them with their arrest warrants. I wrote the search warrants, the electronic surveillance. I went out with the SWAT team when we were called out in hostage situations just to make sure that everything was done legally. We had to make sure that the packages, ultimately the arrests, were viable for when we presented them to the prosecutor. And prior to working with the Department of Law Enforcement, I was a prosecutor for 5 years with the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. So I knew exactly what a prosecutor needed in order to present a case to a jury and a judge. So as a legal advisor, I had to make sure the agents kept their cases on the up and up and down the legal straight and narrow so that everything would work out eventually when we got a suspect in court.
It sounds like proper Miami Vice, but was it as glamorous as all that?
I don't know if glamorous is the word, but it was definitely exciting. Being a prosecutor in Miami, I was there for about 5 years, and I have to tell you, it's probably one of the most exciting things I've ever done, and the most fulfilling and rewarding job I've ever had. You walk into Miami, and I like to say that the justice is swift and Southern fried. We don't believe in indictments like they do on, say, shows like Law and Order and other things that you might have seen on American television. We file charges in Miami by information, which means basically right after a suspect is arrested, you as the prosecutor bring in the witnesses, the cops, the victims, and you swear them in. They tell you the story, and you file the charges. So there's no indictment unless it's a first-degree murder or a juvenile that's bound over for adult court. So you're involved in the process right off the bat, and it's very exciting. You have victims in your office. You walk over to court. I handled 168 cases one day set for trial. I mean, it was incredible, the volume of cases that come through Miami.
So working as a regional legal advisor for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was better than writing court dramas?